Okay. Thank you very much. I'd like to call to order the Transportation and Transit Policy and Oversight Division meeting. We're going to just go with who we have in terms of authors right now, and we have a crowded agenda, and then we're starting late because of session. So I would like to just skip down to agenda item number 8, House File 700, Representative Demmer. And Representative Demmer, I'll move that House File 700 be recommended to pass, and we'll place this one on the general register. If it were to pass. If it were to pass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got a couple of handouts coming around. Mr. Chair, first of all, I got a real quick three-word oral amendment.
Okay, you can move that, Representative Demmer. I'll move that.
Okay, on line 1.11, members, at the end of that sentence, we want to put in rural areas.
Okay, we're getting oriented here. Okay. So, could you repeat the proposed oral amendment again?
Sure. Mr. Chair, on line 1.11, at the very end of the sentence, in rural areas. So okay. It would read, within a job opportunity building zone in rural areas.
Okay. Members, do you have any questions of the author on the oral amendment? Representative Erdahl?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Demmer, what is a rural area? Are we saying outside the 7-county metro area, or what is a rural area?
Actually, I can talk about that in a bit, but the reason we're doing rural areas, I'll talk about it now, Mr. Chair. The whole idea behind this is that these signs, we only want to be in the outside of a city or outside of a metropolitan area. We have two different things going in this bill, which we'll talk about. We're looking at businesses that are already designated as Job Z sites. If they're a Job Z site, they're by definition not in the 7-county metro area because there aren't any in the metro area. The other thing we want to make sure is that there are Job Z sites in small towns, such as what I and you represent. This is not intended for them either. So in rural areas, apparently in MnDOT's definition of rural, it's just not in a city and not in a community. So the idea is I'm trying to have it so these signs are only out in the rural areas, which is not in a city, not in the 7-county metro area, to make sure that we're, and I'll explain why we're doing this to begin with, and I think it'll make sense.
So, Mr. Chair, does that at all? Basically outside of the city limits then in rural Minnesota.
That's correct.
Okay. Is there any other discussion to the author's amendment? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and now we have House File 700 before us in the form that the author would like to present it. So welcome to the committee, and welcome back. We just saw you yesterday.
I'm going to be a regular member, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to have this heard. Members and Mr. Chair, this is a kind of a unique situation that I looked into, first of all, on behalf of one of my constituents, and then in talking with Dee, found out that there are about up to maybe 40 Job Z businesses in townships, let's say, not located in a town, in a city or community. The one in my particular circumstance, you have a picture, and there's a front and back. On the front side, you see a picture of a business, and that's in my community. That business employs about 40 people. They have about 200 and some cement trucks in inventory, and they've invested a couple of million dollars there, and a lot of that, of course, we've got investment as a state, as a Job Z site, and they've exceeded all their goals in terms of membership, employment, investment, and that sort of thing, and have been a good business. They buy used trucks from all over the nation, and then they refurbish these trucks as cement trucks. And they're also now manufacturing cement mixing bodies. And the problems they were having, we dealt with this last spring and actually last summer, is they would get these, they buy these trucks from all of the nation. People would drive these trucks to the business to drop them off, and they couldn't find the business because they are located, as you can see from the picture, they're literally out in the middle of cornfields. They are 2 miles on gravel township roads away from the state highway. And this is a significant business, as you can see from the picture, but you absolutely cannot see it from the highway. And so the roads that they're on are small township gravel roads. They had people coming from around the nation with these trucks who couldn't find their business. They would arrive sometimes after hours, and they were literally driving around the township trying to find the business. The owner was getting phone calls about where's the business. Now, I'm going to back up a little bit. This business used to be a farm about 10 years ago or so. It was a farm equipment type of, they sold parts and that kind of stuff. That qualified them for a blue specific service sign because they were an agriculture-related business. A few years ago, 2 years ago to be exact, or give or take, every 5 years these have to be renewed. One of their secretaries received a call from NDOT asking them about their business and reauthorizing this blue specific service sign. The receptionist said, well, actually we don't do farm parts anymore. Here's our business. Oh, well then you don't qualify for the blue service sign. So the sign came down and there's now no signage at all allowed for them to put up to show where their business is. So what they did is they talked to, there's a large windmill farm here, Garland McNeil's wind farm, and they have a maintenance facility right at the edge of the street. And the back side of your picture shows the area. And they thought, well, they can put a sign up there because the owner of the property was okay for them to put up their Welsh equipment sign or whatever. And so they were going to put up a sign with an arrow to show people where the business was. Well, they came to find out that due to federal regulations, they are not allowed to put up a business sign. So in essence, there's no way for this business, 40 employees, a couple million dollars worth of investment, a jobs each site, to put up a sign to show people where they're located. And so the only thing we could do is try to come back with some mechanism, and the best we could come up with right now after learning that the federal regulations did not allow any kind of discretion either on the state or the county level for a sign, is to use the blue specific service sign. If you look at the picture that's got 670th Street on it, that is a sense of the intersection we're talking about. It's cornfields and state highway. The one thing that we can do is, on the picture below there, it shows 250th Street. You see that sign? That's called a large street sign. That could be put up here to designate the street. That's a larger sign than the blue specific service sign. They cannot put the name of their business on there, and it's at a cost to MnDOT. The blue service sign that I would like them to be able to utilize is smaller than the green sign. They can put their business name on there, and the business pays for it, so there's no fiscal note to this. There's no cost. So in my mind, I thought it was much better to be able to take a blue specific service sign, qualify it with a Job Z designation. Any business has Job Z be designated to be able to utilize one of these blue specific service signs, and craft the language in such a way that literally there'd be maybe less than 40 businesses in the entire state that would be even eligible to do this at their cost if they wanted to. So, Mr. Chair, that's kind of the essence of what I'm trying to accomplish and why I'm trying to accomplish it the way I am.
Okay, thank you very much, Representative Demmer. Before we move on, I wanted to welcome the ninth grade class, some students from St. Louis Park High School. Welcome to our committee. They're participating in the Historical Society's Capital Historic Sites Voice of the People, Your Role in Minnesota Government Tour and Education Program. And I believe this is the third group we've had from St. Louis Park High School. So they're veterans of the Transportation Committee. Welcome them. And Representative Housman has a question. But before I get to that, I just wanted to ask Representative Demmer, is this... I think I visited with you a wind farm in your district a few years ago. Is this the... Okay, so the chair has actually been to 670th Street before. okay, Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, if I could...
Yes.
Quickly, I'm sorry, Representative Hausman. There's one more handout you have, members, and that's just in case you're wondering about the signs. This is off MnDOT's site. It shows the different signs that they have available. And the one we're talking about, of course, is the blue one that says, right, this one says Great Bear Campground, but that's the sign we're talking about.
Okay, and I'm sure that we'll hear from MnDOT if they have any comments. But Representative Hausman, first to the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess more to you and members as much as the author, but I'm assuming we move very carefully with this. I mean, just to get, I know that that's an interstate, but on 94, just to get signs for major colleges, we had a year-long task force to determine whether they could get signs on the highway. I'm a little confused by this because if we're saying, I mean, blue service signs mean something. They mean service for the traveling public. Mm-hmm. And so we're using a designation that has been used for a very specific purpose. I guess my real confusion, though, is why we would specify one business as opposed to any number of businesses. Do we give extra status to businesses established under Job D than any other business that's been in operation forever? So I'm confused about the context of this, and I do think we have to be very careful because there is well-established policy around signs on roadways.
Representative Demmer, did you want to
thank
respond?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hausman, I agree with you. And I don't bring legislation that is specific. Before I did this, I talked with folks at Deed, and I said, are there other businesses in this kind of a situation? Potentially up to 40, but the truth of the matter is it's probably way fewer than that. Number one, as far as the blue specific service signs, if you look at what's eligible, we have retail motor fuel businesses, motels, resorts, recreational camping grounds. We have rural and tourist-oriented businesses. That's what we're doing with these, is directing them to certain places that the public needs to know about. In this particular situation, the public needs to know where this business is because they're delivering items to them. And I'm thinking that there are other businesses out there that may be in a similar circumstance. They are basically boxed out. They can't put a sign up to show where their business is. We, on the one hand, have policies, and we establish public policy that incents people putting businesses out in the rural areas. And then in this situation, we have rules and regulations that box out them, letting people know where it is. We're trying to create jobs, and that's what this is doing. It's also a safety issue because these are trucks. In this particular instance, there are trucks driving around out in the countryside on gravel roads trying to find this business because you literally can't see it. And I'm just thinking there might be other businesses that are very similar to that. I'm not aware that this would be usable on an interstate. I'm not aware that it would be usable in one of those situations. I am sensitive to the fact that we can't, and I did have a couple of ideas that threw out to MnDOT, and this is the best we could come with, because we do have Job Z signs that we've done, for example, towns that have Job Z sites. If you look at their population signs, they have, this is a Job Z community. That was another thought that I had when we talked about a business. But I'm sensitive to what you're saying, and I agree with you. I've had other businesses through the years that have wanted to be on these signs, and I've had to politely argue with my own constituents that maybe this is not suitable for that particular use. I think this rises to a different level. We've got an investment as a state in the Job Z business. The individual has an investment, and these are rural areas. So I just think it meets that criteria.
Okay, thank you. Representative Morrow, and then I'd like to see if MnDOT has a perspective on this, and then I think we need to move on. We have so many bills on the agenda today, and take so little time.
Thank you, Chair. I'll keep it quick. My Representative Hausman's points were my points, but there was a question that she asked that I don't think Representative Demmer was answered. I'm worried about the businesses that aren't within Job Z but have the same issues. I know in my district I have people get trucks as well getting lost. This doesn't seem like the solution for that problem, and it wouldn't address their issue. So on one hand, I would argue you need a broader solution, and the second, I would argue you don't need a service sign solution. But maybe MnDOT's got another proposal on the table.
Representative Demmer, you can respond, and then I think the committee would like to hear from MnDOT.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Morrow, the answer to your question is the answer to the concerns that you and Representative Hausman had. We can't open this up to everybody. There are lots of benefits that Job D businesses have that other businesses don't have. They make a significant commitment in terms of hiring. They make a significant commitment in terms of investment to qualify as a Job Z business. This is another benefit that they get, albeit it's a relatively small one, but I think it's an important one. The other businesses that are out there that would like to advertise, as I just mentioned, I have a couple of myself that I pretty much told them that, you know, we can't have every business on these signs. And quite frankly, as I mentioned too, I'm open to another solution to this. This is one that has no cost to MnDOT or the state. It's very simple. Quite frankly, they'd rather have a big sign with their logo on it, but this at least accomplishes the goal of saying this is where they're located.
Thank you. Is there someone from the, I don't know if it's the Office of Signs, Ms. Isaacson, the state traffic engineer. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. An assistant state traffic engineer.
Okay.
I don't want to take anything away from my boss.
I gave you a promotion.
That's okay. I don't think it comes with any benefits. I do have a few comments here, and actually the committee and Representative Dimmer have done a good job of discussing some of the issues that MnDOT has. We do have a concern with expanding the specific services signing program to manufacturing types of businesses. Most of our signs are motorist services such as gas stations, restaurants, and then also things that have a broad motorist appeal. We do appreciate the time that the author has spent with the district trying to develop certainly a solution for the navigational issues that have been identified, and that is the advanced street name sign that you see in your packet that has the street with an arrow. You don't see those as often in rural areas. Sometimes those rural intersections have primarily local traffic. However, we do work with local road authorities to install those signs when there is a need. One correction, on the cost of those, the initial cost, frequently they're paid by the local road authority who has the ability to charge a business for those signs. MnDOT does take over the maintenance of those after they're installed, but that initial cost is typically paid by a local authority or the business themselves. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from Ms. Isaacs and Representative David.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, Representative Demmer, I think you've got a very good bill here, and I think it's a very reasonable bill, and we should just do this. As far as the service sign, maybe, I don't know, to the person from MnDOT who just testified, if he put a couple gas pumps in by the third door, then it'd be a service. Is there some service he could provide so that we could get a sign?
In terms of the specific service signing statute, it would be... a gasoline service station has to provide fuel, obviously. They have to be open a certain number of hours per day, days per week. They have to provide motor oil. I believe, and I would have to go back and look, that maybe you even have to have toilets open to the public, all those kinds of things. And their primary business needs to be what's identified in that statute. So a gasoline service station needs to be a gasoline service station under existing statute, yes.
Well, members, I'm hoping,
David.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm hoping we can support the Dimmer bill here.
Dimmer? I have members. I have a question for Ms. Isaacson. Do you have any concerns that a bill like this might set a precedent that you know? I think you had mentioned that there's a lot of other businesses that may want signage like this. Is there a concern that with this bill there may be some precedent set that would, you know, open the so-called floodgates to legislation like this?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we are concerned about that. As I mentioned, you know, typically, and we sign for facilities that are not in a specific services signing law, facilities that are allowed by federal and state standards to be signed. But all of those facility types, the thing they have in common is that they're either a motorist service, those gas stations, restaurants, those sorts of facilities, or they have a broad motorist appeal, something like a state park or other recreational, cultural, tourist-oriented types of facilities. And there's no doubt we get hundreds, thousands of requests each year for signs. We work very hard to meet the needs of businesses. We can't meet the needs of all businesses, though. There's a huge demand for signing on our highway system. Everyone feels they need a sign and deserve a sign, and we simply can't satisfy all those needs.
Okay, and then one final question from me, Ms. Eisen. Is there, given you know, the case that Representative Dimmer made for this particular industry, is there... do you have some options or ideas or suggestions about what could happen short of legislation to address this issue with this business and with Representative Dimmer?
Mr. Chairman, the representative worked with our district, and he also worked with our office to try and come up with something. The advanced street name sign is that's what MnDOT can do in terms of that helps that navigation issue. Something with the business name on it, I don't think so. For example, the communities with the community identification sign, that's a boundary sign. It's not a directional sign. Once you move into directional signs, you get into the manual on uniform traffic control devices, and you also get into this statute.
Okay, we'll have one final question from Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein. Question, Representative Demmer, in Wabasha County, we just recently moved to rural addressing, and along with rural addressing, they put up the township sign, so at every gravel road, it's a street or an avenue number. In the county that we're talking about where this is located, is there a sign at that gravel road saying what street or avenue it is?
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Welty, yes. It's 670th Street, and there's a street sign that's that big. And quite frankly, it's off. As you know, we have pretty wide ditches, and it's on the field side of the ditch. And it's unless you kind of know exactly where it is and can see it as you're driving by at 55, I'm sure everybody's going 55 miles an hour, it's hard to see. And that's the issue. And a lot of these things are delivered at night to these trucks, and so they can't see them. But yes, there is a sign there. It's 670th Street. And I just want to mention, too, that the district office in Rochester I worked with and spent quite a bit of time, a number of phone calls, they were very good to work with me and actually came up with some thoughts and ideas. And the street sign was one that did come up, and it's a solution I think is probably doable, but quite frankly, I think this is a smaller sign at a cost to the business as opposed to the state. And I think because it's a Job Z site, this does reach a different threshold than just any business that's out in the rural area, and that's why I went this route.
Okay, members, I think that my understanding is that there's some questions about where this bill is at in the Senate. I think it would be maybe more prudent for us to lay this over in our body for possible inclusion. Let's continue some conversations with MnDOT. Then your bill stays, you know, active that way. And but you know, there are a number of questions I think still need to be answered. And then with what's happening in the Senate, if it's okay with you, Representative Demmer, I think we'll just lay this over for possible inclusion. And then at least there's a vehicle for you here in the House.
Thank you, Mr. Hennick. It's reasonable, and I'll check with my senator again and see where we're at with it.
Okay, and then we'll communicate about that.
Thank you.
Okay, members, we'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion in an omnibus transportation policy. Thank you, Representative Demmer, and we'll now revert back to the top of the agenda, item 4, Representative Nelson, House File 1464.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I missed being on this committee, but go for it from there. I'll file 1464.
Representative Nelson, we'll lay this also, hold it over for possible inclusion in a transportation omnibus bill as well. I'll make that motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, committee, the reason for this bill is I've been contacted by the United Transportation Workers, our union, and the other rail labor regarding this bill, about Minnesota Statute 174.86, which is the Commuter Rail Corridor Coordinating Committee. Say that by three times fast. Anyway, as part of that charge, the Commuter Rail Coordinating Committee has safety listed as one of their priorities. The railroad workers also have safety as one of their first charges within their duties of operating trains and the decisions that trains in the corridors. And the CCRC can make the future, in the future will affect their safety working in these corridors. With me today is Jennifer Schaubach from the Minnesota AFL-CIO and members from the rail labor in Minnesota that can speak to this bill. Over the last century, the railroad labor has run the trains and built the lines and made valuable contributions to commerce and safety in the state. Looking forward, placing members of the rail labor on the corridor coordinating committee can ensure the safest rail operations possible and positive contributions for the discussion of rail service and safety. I ask that this bill be laid over for possible inclusion in the trail transportation policy omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Shabak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Shabak. I am the legislative director at the Minnesota AFL-CIO, and I was as well contacted just a couple days ago to come forward and in support of House File 1464. We believe that rail labor can make a positive contribution to the assessment and analysis of rail corridors in the metro area and statewide. As Representative Nelson said, as part of his charge, the Commuter Rail Corridor Coordinating Committee, or CRCCC, which is much easier to say, has safety listed. Rail workers, first charged with their duties to operate trains is safety. Decisions that the CRCCC may make in the future will affect their safety while operating their trains. Under the Railway Labor Act, rail workers have a right and unions have a responsibility to protect safety of our membership and advance overall safety. Rail labor has contributed to the North Star Commuter Rail Corridor by filing information in support of MnDOT docket waiver requirements for depot platform compliance while federal standards are created. Rail labor is currently working with the Burlington Northern Santa Fe regarding North Star Commuter Service crew training and expectations of service to the public. Rail labor has a unique and historical perspective when working with the rail carriers in Minnesota and nationwide. On an increasing basis, many parties are reaching out to rail labor to learn the true nature of traffic routes, rail corridor capacities, and safety needs. We can assist and provide a level of information for other parties on the committee. Minnesota AFL-CIO knows that once commuter or passenger operations have begun, it will be in the best interest of all parties to have established open lines of communication to deal with various safety and service issues that may arise. Rail labor's contribution should not be seen as an interference, but rather a resource. Thank you for your time. And if there's any questions, there are rail labor representatives here.
Thank you very much, Ms. Shabak. Are there questions of the testifier or the author at this point? Representative Holbrook, you look like you're contemplating a question.
Mr. Chair, I'm just curious to see if the Met Council or MnDOT has a position on this bill.
I don't see the Met Council. I do see MnDOT.
And while they're coming down, I'm just wondering if we're going to go down this route, was any consideration given to having a representative from the rail owner there, the railroad?
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Eric Rudin from MnDOT Government Affairs, and the department does not have a position on this bill.
All right. Representative Nelson, did you think at all about putting a representative of that owns the track on this as well for going to put the labor people on?
Can I read you what was already on it? I think they may already be on it. I would not be opposed to that. Currently they have members, each of significant funding partners whose jurisdiction the lines are located. One member is appointed by each county in which the corridors are located. One member by each city in which advanced corridor plans indicate that a station may be located. There are two members appointed by the commission, one of whom is designated by the commission, as the chair of the committee. One member appointed by the Metropolitan Planning Commission, or planning organization, through which the commuter lines pass. There's one member appointed by the president of the University of Minnesota. And then we're just trying to add two more people that have from labor that deal with safety on a regular basis.
Well, I don't. Is this getting, Mr. Chair? Is this getting laid over?
Yes.
Or is it moving out?
It's getting laid over.
I don't want to belabor the point in the interest of the committee's time, but I think if you're going to have rail labor on this, you really need the balance of having the rail owners on it as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Holbrook. Do you have any concluding comments? Are there any other questions from the committee? Representative Nelson.
Okay, like I said in my statement, safety is the rail labor, the people that work on these lines, the safety is their number one concern in these lines and these corridors, and that's why they're asking to be part of this, because what happens in these lines when they put commuter rail or commuters in there, which are now dangerous places to work anyway, but that would these people and all their safety on their job might be compromised, and so they would like to have a voice there.
Okay, thank you. Is any anyone else in the public that wishes to testify for and against or claim neutrality on the bill? Okay, well, with that, members, we will lay this bill also over for...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
We have House File 1547, Representative Portman, and we're also going to be... I don't know if Representative Adler is here. I think we've sent someone to retrieve him. These bills are kind of both similar, so we'd like to hear them together. So the principles of design build are... fresh in people's minds.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Portman, welcome.
I would move that House File 1547 be recommended to pass, and I would imagine referred to Transportation Finance Committee.
Well, actually, Representative Portman, because of the impact for local units of government, we have talked with the State and Local Government Operations Committee, and they would like to see it. So. That's where we'll head from here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to say I don't think that there is similarity between my bill and Representative Abler's in one very important respect. And Representative Abler's proposal is about a specific project in his community. And what House File 1547 does is it sets up a process that is not project specific. So I don't think they really belong in the same category of discussion, except that they both touch on the issue of design build.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, when we passed Chapter 152 last year, part of that process was we set up a task force of business entities to take a look at the way that MnDOT operated and to make some recommendations on how things could be improved going forward. And one of the areas of significant interest for the business community was how successful design build was in certain situations. And one of the things that they advised was that MnDOT and other transportation agencies look at places which design build might also be used to accelerate projects. But as we started talking about in the Transportation Finance Committee, there's some complexities with design build, and it's not as simple and straightforward as it would seem at first blush of speeding things up and doing things a different way and faster. There's a lot of factors that need to be considered as we look more deeply at design build. And the city engineer for the city of Brooklyn Park, Gary Brown, is here with me to help present House File 1547. And Mr. Chair, we have an amendment, the DE1 amendment. And I want to move this amendment. I apologize for it being a delete all and for members of the committee getting it today, but I don't believe that there are significant differences between this draft and the bill draft. There are some minor changes. So, Mr. Chair, I would move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like it to be.
Okay, so the Speaker Pro Tem moves the DE1 amendment. Is there any discussion to the DE1 amendment? Okay. All in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion carries, and now we have 1547 in the shape that the author would like it. So, Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, my name is Gary Brown. I'm the Director of Engineering and Building Inspection for the City of Brooklyn Park, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak to this bill. On behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities, the City Engineers Association of Minnesota and the County Engineers Association. We would encourage the committee to give strong consideration for this bill that would allow design-build type contracts to be used by municipalities, and that certainly would include counties. It's not our intent to use these type of contracts for our normal type reconstruction or construction type contracts, but to use design-build as a process to react to the public needs in the event of an emergency. God forbid it would be something like 35W. MnDOT is not the only public agency, however, that owns and maintains bridges. Many cities have bridges and have large culverts that are considered as bridges. While they are annually inspected, they are still subject to damage from washouts and floods, just as state and county bridges are. Traffic signals could also be as design build when circumstances such as a washed out road or a major accident requiring expedited construction to repair or replace $250,000 of traffic signals. Most people, including my wife, doesn't understand how we could possibly spend $250,000 for four poles with lights on them. Most municipal staff do not have the experience or the knowledge to design bridges or traffic signals. And when this work needs to be done in a hurry, it would be helpful to skip the 6 to 8 week process that of selecting an engineer to prepare the design and advertise for the work. Design build would allow construction to begin much earlier, materials to be ordered earlier, and provide a safe and economical solution for repairing that damage. I believe that a bill that allows for only a limited number of contracts through a pilot program, which 1547 does, over a 3-year period is a very prudent way to answer many questions about design build. We believe the oversight called out in the bill will safeguard our limited resources. I would stand for any questions the committee might have.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Are there questions of committee members? Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, my questions are probably for the bill author or somebody from MnDOT or Mr. Werke.
Why don't we see if Mr. Werke is here or...
Mr. Chair, I could, just while we're waiting, because I wouldn't be surprised if he's on his way over from the Senate, but I did want to remark that Doug Fisher from Anoka County wanted to be here today also to testify, but since he was just here yesterday to testify as a favor for Representative Abler, he wanted to convey that the county engineers are also supporting this bill and have worked on this process with the city engineers and with MnDOT and with the Associated General Contractors.
Okay, and I'm assuming Holbert, this is still a work in progress, and given it's deadline week, I'm not sure where this is going or what's happening, but there are data issues spelled out in MnDOT's design bill as far as when information is public. Does your process here follow the exact same design build process that MnDOT has, and does your... The data practices issues spelled out as far as when people can discover and what they can discover in the bid process?
Mr. Chair, if I could introduce to the committee Ryan O'Connor from the Association of Minnesota Counties, who spent quite a long time in working on putting the bill together. And one of the things that we've tried to do with the bill draft is to mirror the design build process in MnDOT, and we're watching the Beard bill very carefully because it's going to make some tweaks to the design build process at MnDOT, and we're planning to incorporate those tweaks into our concept here. So with that, Mr. Chair, if I could have Mr. O'Connor address the question.
Mr. O'Connor, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holbert, I think Representative Portman did an excellent job describing that. There's not a specific spot in here that talks about data practices, but again, if that is the process used by MnDOT and it's statutorily outlined, we've tried to incorporate their statutorily designed process whenever feasible. And if I could, to just help provide some possible clarification, the only thing I want to say in addition to that, there were a couple handouts provided to committee members on the design build process. And the front page, what you see is an attempt at a complete process flow chart of how this would work from inception of the bill all the way through to when a contract would be awarded to a selected firm. It's meant to hopefully answer some systematic questions, but then on the second page, or on the back of that page, excuse me, there are 5 notable points about design build, and one of them is to try and, the point 3, take advantage of MnDOT's knowledge and experience associated with using design build whenever possible. We want to use their process. So, and then the final pages have some more general information about design build if you're interested. But to answer your question, Representative Holbert, that would be our intent to be as specific to the current statute as possible.
And if I might, just for clarification purposes, because we had a bill last year carried by Representative Chalen that got very controversial on the same process, and it seemed like it was kind of a total breakdown of the camps, if you will. And so just for the record, it's your intent that your bill would mirror the design-build process currently in place, or revisions supported by MnDOT in a Kumbaya bill by the Representative Beard is carrying, and that in fact your bill now, or your intent for your bill, is not that it would enact some of the controversial reforms that were in the Kalin bill last year.
Thank you for the question, Representative Portman.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, yeah, I think there were some problems with the bill last year. It was sort of an outgrowth of some of the members who thought the 35W bridge was awarded correctly and some didn't, and that was sort of a vehicle for griping, and none of the elements of the Kalin bill are in here.
And Mr.
Chair, finish answering the question. And we are not intending to plow forward unless there's agreement from MnDOT and the contracting community and the municipalities about how to go forward.
All right, thank you. I appreciate that. And again, I'm sorry to take the time on a busy day, but
those are very helpful and important questions, Representative Holberg.
And I'll offline work on the data issues and stuff.
Okay. Are there any other questions of committee members? Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify either for or against this bill? Welcome, Jeremy. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Chair, members, Jeremy Essenson, Minnesota Chamber. For the reasons that Representative Portman laid out, as partners in the funding bill last year, as partners with the task force this summer, we're very interested in understanding which project delivery tools work best for which project and at which level of government. We think this bill would be a great first step in starting to understand some of that. Thank you. I believe, Representative Portman, that this was an agenda item in the commission that you served on with the Chamber of Commerce and others late last year and early this year that came out of our legislation. MnDOT Efficiency Working Group. I don't know remember the former title of that. This bill doesn't come out of that, but it was discussed, these ideas. Okay, is there anyone else that wishes to testify or any questions of the members of our author? Okay, well, with that, then I would, Representative Portman removes her motion that House File 1547 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the as amended. And be re-referred to the State and Local Government Operations Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much. And what I'd like to do, now we had heard Representative Abler's bill yesterday. This is House File 1074. He's, I think, presenting a bill somewhere else, as I understand it. And we've already heard this. So, this bill is also going to state and local government operations. That's where these design bills for local projects go, or in the case of Representative Portman, which was a task force. I don't think we need to have additional testimony or the author, so I will move that House File 1074 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the State and Local Government Operations Committee. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Davis.
Is there a DE2 amendment that needs to go on today?
Let me ask the committee administrator that. there was a DE2 amendment in the packet. And oh, yeah, okay, that was adopted yesterday. That was at a time when I wasn't with the gavel, so I don't specifically recall that.
Mr. Chair, I think too that it's actually a two-project bill now. I think there was a Mason amendment that got adopted.
Okay.
Two.
Representative Portman.
Mr. Chair, I thought when this bill was in front of the Transportation Finance Committee yesterday that the chair of that committee held it over for possible inclusion in an omnibus. So I don't recall us actually voting on the bill and moving it anywhere. Yesterday was this committee.
Yeah.
The Abler bill last night.
Yeah, that was in this committee, and it was laid over till today.
Thank you, Mr. Joe. They all run together. I was in civil law for a long time last night. Also,
it's deadline week. Okay. So, are there any other questions about House File 1074 as amended?
Mr. Chair.
One moment, please. Okay. Mr. Burris has informed me that this is a Senate file. There's a Senate file issue with this, and do you want to explain this, Representative or Mr. Burris? Because I think I'm not going to
represented accurately the process issue that Mr. Burris will has flagged for us.
Mr. Chair and members, the Senate, the companion Senate file, excuse me, the companion Senate file for Representative Abler's bill is actually in this committee now. The committee could move out the Senate, the House file if it chose to. Another option would be to amend the same changes that were made to Representative Abler's bill onto the Senate file and move that file out. There would be there are trade-offs. There's arguably a process advantage to moving the Senate file as far as efficiency of not having to move the House file out of the House and to the Senate and through Senate committees in order to get to the point where both bodies have acted on the bill if it were to pass the committees that would be necessary for it to pass.
Okay. So, if I'm understanding correctly, Mr. Burson, the motion should be to move S-470.
Mr. Chair, if the committee chose to work with the Senate file, the first step would be to amend on the same amendments onto the Senate file that were done onto to the House file and then move it out of committee.
Okay. Does the committee have a preference here? And it's difficult without the author, but Representative Portman.
Mr. Chair, as a co-author of Representative Abler's bill, I just would recommend that we, whichever route we choose, the Senate file or the House file, that we vote it down. This committee has had a practice of not forwarding individual project bills out of the committee. When the author is here with their members of their local community, we usually lay it over for possible inclusion rather than voting on it. But this legislature has a practice of not earmarking specific projects for any reason, whether it's striping or to do design build, and I just don't think we want to start varying with that practice and procedure now. So I will be voting against moving this bill.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Holbert.
One thing that might be an option is you could move to take the bill off the table, and depending what happened with that in the absence of the author being here, etc., it may be a more gentle way to deal with the bill in this situation, and then we would still always have the opportunity as a committee to remove it from the table, bring that motion up again, remove it from the table if in fact there was a time in which the committee wanted to move it forward rather than an up or down vote on the bill.
Thank you, Representative Holbrook. We were just discussing that I think it would be, well, I think that Representative Hortman raises some legitimate policy concerns. I think to vote down a bill without the author, certainly there's probably precedent for that, but it'd probably be maybe would be my preference to lay the bill on the table and, again, the reality of this is that that's where the bill is now, and the reality is if it goes to state and local government operations, were we to vote it out, it would not move this year anyway. So let's keep it in our committee, and I would move then to lay the bill on the table. But is there a discussion? Is there a discussion?
I think there is.
Representative Mason.
Can I ask one question?
Yes.
Will that delay, I think both of the communities have some projects in mind, so would that, what we're going to do, delay those projects or change anything?
Well, Representative Mason, the reality is, under any circumstance, I don't really find a scenario, barring an amendment on the floor, that this bill would move through the committee process, either the House or Senate version, in time to make deadline, particularly with our process in the House where this would have to go to the State and Local Government Operations Committee. So I think the reality is that I think this bill would stay, available to us to act on, but probably not until 2010. I mean, I think that's the scenario no matter what we do, but this would keep the bill in our committee rather than move it on to state government operations or kill it. I mean, so those are the three options, I think, before us.
Well,
Representative Holbrook.
Mr. Chair, it has made first deadline in the Senate if it's here as a Senate file. So there is some time if they wanted to move it next week, May 2nd deadline or whatever. But my concern actually is with Representative Hortman's bill, if the Senate file is going to meet deadline. I don't know if Representative Nelson's still around, but I don't think he's meeting again this week.
That is my understanding as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, my understanding is that our bill is meeting deadline in the Senate. With respect to the specific road projects and whether delaying this bill would delay those road projects, I think is a different question. And the current law is that communities like Anoka County and Dakota County cannot use design build. And the process that we're putting forward in my bill would allow it in certain very prescribed circumstances. Now, it could be that both of those projects are ones that would apply and could go through that process if we do this pilot program. But I don't think that the decision we're making on whether or not to give them special permission over every other county in the state to use design build really determines when they get done. I think that's a different question.
Okay. Members, I'm going to just lay this bill over because we don't have the author here. And so.
Chairman, if I was saying anything, this is going to be all the governor's test.
Well, I think there'll be opportunities to promote that. So, okay, we're back to our agenda now. Number 7, House File 1191. Good to have the author here. Representative Hortman, what is the motion for House File 1191?
Mr. Chair, I would imagine that this would also need to go through state and local government because it has an impact on metropolitan government. So I would move that House File 1191 be recommended to pass and they refer to state and local government.
Okay. Okay. We understand that Representative Nelson did not want to see this, so we'll hold this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Okay, Representative Hortman, we'll hold it over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question would be whether we should send it to Transportation Finance to hold it over for possible inclusion, or whether I should stay here.
I'll ask. I don't believe there's a cost, but I will make sure that we have the correct information from Ms. Ewers.
I can always offer it as an amendment to Transportation Finance. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's ironic that we have the person who wrote the...
One moment.
Originally.
I had a question from Ms. Ewers about fiscal impact here.
Mr. Chair and members, a fiscal note was done on the bill, and there are no costs associated with it.
Okay. So I don't think you have to go to Transportation Finance. Clarify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wonder if that's the place it sort of fits in terms of language. But what this bill does is it expands the opportunity for making loans to communities to acquire property that's in the right-of-way for projects. Right now, when a community knows that a trunk highway is going to be built in their community, they don't have a lot of tools to acquire property to set it aside and protect it from development so that when the state and the federal resources are finally available, that property isn't developed and more expensive to buy. And this would take the existing loan program and put even a little bit more flexibility into it to not require that the homeowner be in a hardship situation in order for the municipality to get a loan from the Metropolitan Council to acquire the property.
Do you have a testifier, Representative Hortman?
Mr. Chair, since he's here, the city engineer from the City of Brooklyn Park, my understanding is this language was originally put into place by then-Representative Schreiber of the Brooklyn Park area to help set aside land for 252,
And this idea came up to increase the flexibility in a meeting of what things we could do to continue to ready the area for Trunk Highway 610. And so with that, if Mr. Brown, if you have any comments.
Mr. Chairman.
Welcome back, Mr. Brown.
Thank you. As most of you have been reading about Trunk Highway 610, it looks like it's in line to get stimulus funds. And the reason for that is that a number of the right-of-ways were purchased with Ralph funds to allow for that right-of-way to be shovel-ready, if you will, at this point in time. Or we wouldn't be in the situation we are in today. What has limited us to acquire some of the other parcels was this description of hardship. And a number of months ago, when we were trying to position ourselves to be ready for some type of federal activities, Representative Portman attended a meeting along with the Speaker of the House, and we addressed this as a concern. And I think it's not only in Brooklyn Park and Maple Grove, but in a number of communities where highways have been laid out, and the Ralph funds have been used when it dealt with hardship. But in this case, what she's attempting to do with this legislation is to allow us to negotiate with willing sellers. We're not looking at condemnation, but just willing sellers who are not in that hardship and don't meet that definition. I stand for any questions.
Questions of the testifier, Mr. Brown? Okay. Is there anyone in the audience or public that wants to testify either in support or in opposition to House File 1191? Okay, Representative Portman, do you have any concluding comments?
No, Mr. Chair, I would just, I guess, renew my motion that it be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus transportation policy bill.
Okay. Representative Ellis, did you have? Okay. So moved. And that bill will be laid over for possible inclusion. Now, we have one final bill, and Representative Liebling here, or agents thereof. Hey, we can put out an APB for Representative Liebling. That is our last bill today. It looks like we will probably be able to finish on or near our schedule to 2:30. So, we will move the minutes at this point.
Move, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Davis. These are the minutes of our meeting on the 24th. All those in favor of the Davis motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, and the motion does prevail, and Representative Liebling is here. Okay. Thank you.
Well, thank you for hearing my bill, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Liebling, House File 1164, I will move for possible inclusion to the for inclusion in the omnibus transportation policy bill, which we are working on as a committee.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know what? One of the big motivators behind this bill and my bringing this forward this year is the fiscal situation that the courts are in, And this really does impact the courts, and I have a testifier here to explain this a little bit more, but I think that this is a bill that it has been around for a while. Representative Lesch carried it in the past, and it has support from all sides. In the when we had a hearing in civil justice, Representative Cornish was very in favor of this bill because he's somebody who understands how the system works, how the courts work. And basically, this is to prevent a revolving door in the courts where somebody gets a license suspension and they're picked up again. Maybe they have done part of what they need to do to get reinstated, but they get picked up again, and then they're going to pay a fine or whatever happens from being convicted again of driving on a suspended license, but then the Department of Public Safety again suspends their license. And people get into a revolving door that the main effect of which is really to clog up the court. So I'm going to now turn it over to my testifier, and he's going to introduce himself and explain a little more about the bill.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee. My name is Travis Schwantes, and I am the managing attorney over at the Public Defender's Office in Stillwater. I've been in Minnesota as a public defender for about the last 8 or 9 years, and before that I was a public defender for 4 years in Wisconsin. In my practice, we handle about 90% of all felonies, about 80% of all misdemeanors. On a typical misdemeanor calendar in Washington County, in Stillwater, about half of the calendar is driving after suspension charges. This is a calendar that also has domestic abuse cases, misdemeanor theft cases, receiving stolen property, fraud, DUI cases, but about half or nearly half of them are driving after suspension cases. People come into court, they apply for and they qualify for a public defender. On these DAS cases, there are court resources in the form of a judge, a judicial aide, a court reporter, a prosecutor, a defense attorney, and we're all in court. And there's not a lot of agreement in criminal court. There's not a lot of agreement among judges about how to handle things in criminal court. We often say that if you get 10 judges together, they'll have 11 different opinions. But in Stillwater, and every other judge that I've ever known and been in front of, there is agreement that the way we need to treat these driving after suspension cases is we bring them into court, we continue the case to give the citizen an opportunity to get valid. Because the judges have decided that it's much better to have valid drivers on the road than to have them resolve their case and ram the case through the system, have them get a conviction for driving after suspension, which activates DPS, driver's license suspension, which makes it further difficult for the person to ever get valid, be on the road driving as a valid driver, which obviously prevents the driver from getting insurance. So what the judges have said is, let's continue this case out 3 months. The case gets continued. The person does what they can to get valid, which includes, working to pay fines. Sometimes they come back to court and they are valid. They plead guilty to a lesser offense and then their license doesn't get suspended. The benefit of this bill is it allows somebody to come into court who said, yeah, I screwed up, I violated the law. They can plead guilty to driving after suspension, and then their license doesn't get suspended yet again. So it keeps a number of extra court appearances out of the court system. Somebody that might, under the current law, take 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 court appearances to get their case done, now only takes 1 court appearance. That's a big deal for the court system. There's less cases. We can focus on more important cases of public safety. It's important for the people that are drivers. They can get valid sooner. It's important for the public because if they get into a car accident, they're less likely to be in an accident with a driver that doesn't have insurance. I also think it's important, there may be a disagreement from DPS. I believe there is disagreement on the point I'm about to make. What this law does is it means that the court isn't sending additional notices to DPS to suspend driver's license. In other words, it doesn't require any additional action by DPS to follow or to implement this bill, because they're not getting notices from the court system that says you've got to suspend this driver's license. They don't have to take any action. So I can't imagine that there would be any additional cost for them. I think this is a smart bill. I think it's reasonable. The court system is trying to prioritize what is important to handle in this day with limited resources, and the bench has decided, look, it's more important for us to spend resources on crimes of violence and other things that deal with public safety. This is a case that we can resolve much better if there wasn't that driver's license additional cumulative suspension that people got for DASs. And with that, I'm here to take any questions that you have.
Okay, Representative Swales.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I visited the Washington County Court this last May and went on a ride along with 4 of our judges from the Washington County Government Center. And I know exactly what it is that you're talking about. And we do have courts that are under stress, and I think this is a very reasonable solution, and I hope that we're able to enact this.
Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? I do see Ms. McCormick here, and I would like to hear her perspective on the bill. Welcome back to the committee, Ms. McCormick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And while in most times I only speak to you in terms of my authority as a division director, at this point in time, the department has asked me to speak also on behalf of the Minnesota State Patrol and the Office of Traffic Safety. As you know, with all the committee deadlines, we are stretched thin right now with getting to hearings and things. So we have prepared some written testimony, and I'd also just like to address a little bit of the testimony that we just heard. But I just wanted to say that, as all of you know, the department suspends driving privileges of a person when they've exhibited poor driving behavior that's placed themselves or others in danger. And this behavior can include multiple speeding violations, fleeing an officer, driving with no license, or a license that's the incorrect class. For instance, someone driving a truck that only has a Class B license, or perhaps not with insurance. Statistics have shown that suspended drivers are 2 times more likely to be involved in a fatal crash. And by suspending driving privileges, the department is attempting to intervene with the person's poor driving behavior and send a clear message that the driving is a privilege that are afforded to those that drive safely. Way too many lives have been lost and are lost, and injuries occurring because people aren't driving safely. Removing the sanctions that are called for in this bill weakens the integrity of our licensing system and really endangers public safety. What's the incentive for a driver to change behavior and pay fines if there's no additional suspension? Minnesota State Patrol believes that the additional suspension time does serve as a deterrent to those who would comply with the suspension for fear of getting their suspension time extended. At the same time, the department certainly understands that right now we are facing people that are getting into a cycle of getting their license suspended over and over again. And currently, we do have a multi-agency driver's license sanction committee that's reviewing what the department can do to more effectively address people that could get caught into this cycle of getting continuing suspensions. So one of our major goals of the sanction committee is to find a way to help people get legal and quickly, as quickly as possible, but still by changing driver behavior. We would strongly suggest that this legislation to hold additional suspensions wait until after our committee has completed its review and its report and recommendations, which we expect to be done by the fall of this year. In addition to that, I would just like to say that currently our practice is that if you fail to appear in court or you fail to pay a fine, we do not resuspend an individual for those kinds of violations. But the violations that we're talking about in this bill, if you've looked them over, we're talking about people who are habitually reckless, habitual violators of traffic laws, incompetent to drive a motor vehicle. These are when they may have been first suspended for failure to appear or failure to pay a fine, but then they commit one of these other offenses. These offenses would still have to be put on the driving record. So this is not preventing. The problem with us right now is that those offenses come over and the statute site is listed, and our staff have to manually go in and review the stats, review what that violation is, and then review the record to see what other offenses are on that record and to determine whether or not action needs to be taken. And so our concern is that we really believe
and would strongly suggest that at this time we wait and see what the work of our sanctions committee, what type of action they recommend. This sanctions committee is not just made up of people from DVS. It's made up of county attorneys, defense attorneys, and other representatives of probation to look at ways that we really can truly find a successful way to address this. And we certainly commend Representative Liebling for trying to find a way to address the issues that are before us with people that continually keep offending and keep driving unsafely and ignoring our laws. But we would just suggest that we would wait and look at this after we have our committee and our recommendations.
Representative Welty. Thank you, Ms. McCormick. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. McCormick, I've been on judicial ride-alongs as well, and I can tell you I sat in traffic court, and it was case after case after case after case that came through, and it was driving after suspension. And so do you have on your committee a judge, or do you have on your committee someone from the court system? Because this is a huge issue for the court system. Our court system is at the breaking point right now. You sit down with the judges in the local districts, they will tell you that they're overburdened. Our public defenders are overburdened. There are potential cuts coming down to the courts again, and they just received cuts. We really need to reform some of what we're doing within the judicial system. Do you have a judge, or do you have somebody from the court on your committee?
Mr. Chair and Representative Welty, yes, there is at least one judge. I think there's two judges on there. I'm on the steering committee, so I haven't been at all the actual meetings, but Joan Kupchinski, who's here from Driver Services, is on the working committees, and there's also at least one or two court administrators, aren't there? Yeah. So there's judges and court administrators that are part of this process. And as I said, we really do understand this process. We face this process. We're processing. We're the ones getting the notices from the court and the ones that are having to review all the records to ensure that we're taking the proper action. And so we certainly support it. And we have also worked with the group that's looking at diversion pilot projects as well to advise them as to how to do it in a way that would be something that we would be able to administer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one follow-up. Ms. McCormick, I don't express my frustration at you. I express my frustration at the fact that we have a broken system and we need to fix it. And I guess my question to you and then also to the previous testifier, do you believe that by what Representative Liebling is proposing, it would in any way cause public safety to be put in jeopardy?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Welty, yes, as I testified here, I do have a concern that it would put public safety at jeopardy, and that's why I was asked to testify on behalf of all three divisions, so that we would recommend that we at least wait until we have this report done and that we can ensure that what we're doing is not ignoring these types of violations that are listed. And because I'm not sure that people understand that we do not resuspend someone because of failure to appear or failure to pay a fine. We do not resuspend you. Yes, your suspension is on the record, but if those are the violations that come in, we are not resuspending you. But at the same time, you still have it on your record. At the same time, these other violations would be on the record, and it would state that we would not be able to suspend you for these other violations. And that's the concern that we have, because these are serious violations in terms of what the Department of Public Safety administers.
Thank you very much. Representative Liebling, do you want to respond, and I guess to anything, obviously, that the testifier said, and I would be particularly interested in your thoughts about the idea of delaying it until this task force is has its work completed in fall. So, but whatever you would want to respond to, but I'd be interested in your response.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, let me just respond on the issue of safety. You know, it sounds to me like Ms. McCormick is almost reading a different bill than the one that we've got here, because what this bill does is just say that when you're convicted of driving after suspension, that you don't get suspended. That's all. So these other convictions, you know, for bad driving behavior, you still get suspended for those. It's just when you're convicted of driving after suspension that you don't get resuspended. So I don't really see the public safety impact of that at all, Representative Welty. And I think what we want people to have a valid license. I mean, this committee, I'm sure, is more up on this than I am, but, you know, we want them to have insurance, most importantly, and being able to get their license back, going through the proper steps, is really important for that reason. In terms of the urgency of this, just this morning I had a meeting with Sue Dosal, who's the administrator for the Supreme Court, and we had a very good conversation. I'm on the Public Safety Finance Committee, and she came to me about some bills that they're going to be presenting. And we had a conversation, and I don't want to misquote her, but she said, people don't get that after July, we're going to be in a really different world because of the budget cuts. The court, you know, that's a very conservative institution, and they are saying, give us some tools and give them to us now, because we need to focus on our core functions here. They know, the courts are very aware of what it takes to maintain public safety. I mean, they are really the guardians of public safety, and they are saying, we need to do some things very differently. We need to get these small things out of court. We need to focus on the big stuff. And they're, now, I'm not saying that they're promoting this bill, because I don't know if they are or not, but I think there's some real urgency here in terms of the fiscal situation we're facing. We need to focus on the true public safety things, not on the feel-good stuff.
Okay. Representative Holberg, and just a reminder that we have another committee coming in at 2:45, so we'll take a couple more questions, but we will need to move on. Representative Holberg.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Representative Liebling, will DVS still be notified of these violations?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I don't see anything in the bill that would say they wouldn't be. I would expect they would be.
So in other words, would the court notify DVS that we picked them up again for driving while they were suspended? Or we picked them up for habitual recklessness and we didn't suspend their license because it was already suspended? Are you going to let them know that? Because some of these issues, you get into cumulative violations, et cetera. So I'm not so sure how much the court's still going to have to do that. Right,
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Holberg, I assume so, because the bill does not say otherwise. The bill does not. It just says that you don't get suspended again. It doesn't say the court can't, you know, or won't notify about those issues.
Okay, is there any further discussion to House File 1164? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. The committee knows I like to support MnDOT positions wherever I can. I'm just trying to get clarification. The most common violation reason for suspension would be what?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, I imagine, but I don't have statistics in front of me, would be speeding. And that's where you get into the issue that Representative Holberg was talking about, where it's cumulative, where you have to have 4 and 12 or 5 and 24 months to have suspension take place. And so that's why I disagreed with the testimony before, because I agree with Representative Liebling that the court is still going to be required to send us those violations unless you do something to delete these laws on the books. The court would be required to send us those convictions and moving violations. The issue I'm trying to stress, though, is that right now I do not think that this bill does help because it will, there's cost to it as well. But as I said to Representative Liebling, I'll wait till we get to the budget division to discuss that. And there would be costs with this because the courts and DVS do not interface to easily be able to look at these at these convictions, and so we have to still manually do this work, and we continue to have to manually do the work under this and also do programming changes, because right now if we get this violation, we automatically suspend someone. That's how our system is coded. So we would have to go in, and for each of these offenses, we have to get rid of that code to automatically suspend. And so there are costs to it. But that isn't the reason I was here today. The department asked that I talk about the policy side of the bill.
Okay. Members, I have one. Okay. But I still had a question that I'm not sure was answered, and that is just to the author. Do you have any thoughts about this idea of how we would treat the task force deliberations, or the timing of passing this bill versus assuming waiting another year? I have a sense of what your response will be, but I think it would be helpful to hear it from you.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. If we could put off all of our budget cuts that we're going to make for a year, then I'd say, sure, let's go ahead and wait for a year on that. But there's real urgency this year to give the flexibility to a lot of entities that are going to be dealing with reduction in funds. And I think this is a really important one. And so I really think there is an urgency to this.
Okay. With that, members, we'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion. That's the motion, but if you would like to...
sorry, Mr. Chairman. Have you done enough damage
today? One moment, please. Hold on 1 second.
You did it again.
Okay. Okay, members, just for clarification, we are waiting to see if there is a fiscal note. We are laying this over at this point. We have 48 hours to figure the rest of that out. May be able to include the omnibus bill, but if there's a fiscal implication, then it goes to finance, transportation finance. But we'll make all the appropriate motions in time for this bill to meet deadline. As you know, it was passed already through public safety. So I will lay the bill over. Now, members, quick announcement before. Thank you very much, by the way, Representative Liebling. One very quick announcement, members. We did, Mr. Burris has really worked hard, and we have a pretty good outline of this very small omnibus bill that we're doing. I think we have 6 or 7 provisions, actually, including what we held over today. So we have the Republican caucus has a draft version of this, which you all can share and look over. And what I intend to do is we will meet Friday at 10:30. We still have Representative Scott's bill from Tuesday that we need to take action on. I think there were some issues that had to be worked out on that. There are a couple bills from Representative Swales. Representative Mullery has a bill on ignition locks. And then we're going to do this short omnibus bill. So I wouldn't anticipate that we would meet much past 12 noon on Friday, just if you're planning your weekend activities. But that's really what we have still left on the agenda. Representative Holberg.
Oh, I believe Ways and Means starts at 12:30 for Target. So
okay. So, you know, our Target will be to meet before you do Target.
I've been corrected, Mr. Kane, so it's 12:15.
Even more incentive to show up on time, work quickly and efficiently, and I'm very confident that we can have our business done. And so that will be Friday. If you have any concerns or thoughts, suggestions about the omnibus bill, please contact me and our staff. And then, again, that's at 10:30 on Friday. And then finally, members, we will meet one more time on Wednesday at our regular meeting time to take up a few
Senate files and other, you know, related matters before we meet the second deadline. And then I don't anticipate any more hearings until possibly the interim or next year. So, you know, we'll conclude our work with just two more meetings this year. So thank you very much, members. We stand adjourned.